Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From newsounds.org and the studios of WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck, our series of live performances and interviews. I'm John Schaefer. Roger Eno first came to our attention back in 1983 when he teamed up with his brother Brian and the producer Daniel Lanois on the album Apollo Atmospheres and Soundtracks. Over the next 40 years, Roger would work with musicians as varied as Lou Reed and Lil Raji. He formed the ambient music supergroup Channel Light Vessel in the 90s, scored a number of TV series and films, and in 2020, the album Mixing Colors by Roger and Brian Eno brought him to the prestigious classical music label Deutsche Grammophon. Roger's latest solo release is for that label. It's called The Skies They Shift Like Chords. Roger Eno is at our piano with vocalist Cecily Eno, his daughter, and they're going to start us off with a song called There Was a Ship.
There was a ship that sailed to sea, to foreign lands so far away, and on that ship sailed my love, and with him went the stars above, and with him went the stars. Every day for one long year I'd watch the sails of ships appear. I'd walk the shore in the dying light to stand alone in the starless night, to stand alone. As I began one by one, the stars came out there on the starlit sea. I saw your boat on the starlit sea. Now I'm in arm, we walk the shore to each other's sides no more. We watch the waves as daylight dies and speak our love under starlit skies, and speak our love under starlit skies.
There Was a Ship is the name of that song, performed live here in our studio. Roger Eno at our piano, Cecily Eno singing. And Roger, if you told me that you had gotten that song from an old John McCormick recording from 1911, I would totally believe it. Where is that song from? It's not on any of your records.
It's the strangest thing. I get up every morning, I go to my studio. My studio is above my bedroom. And whatever comes out, I don't edit. The editor visits later. Mm. When I'm up there to begin with, There's only me and a piece of manuscript paper or my computer, and I'll improvise into Logic is the program that I use, if any nerd is out there that's interested. And one day that came out, and I did the same with the lyrics. I thought, what lyrics sound like they'd have been applicable to this song whenever it would have been written. I'm interested in a number of things. History, I'm interested how time affects people, yeah, and the perception of time. So I thought, well, this piece could have been written, as you sort of pointed out, like the turn of the last century, you know, 1910 or something like this. And I thought, well, leave it. Let people decide what they wish to think of it.
Now, that is a song that you and your brother Brian and Cecily, mm-hmm, performed live on the slopes of the Acropolis.
God, what an honor. Yeah.
First of all, how did you... I mean, your brother has been notoriously reluctant to play live.
Yeah, really.
Getting him out there was... That's really a feat.
God, you're not wrong. In fact, a lot of my part was kind of... And I'm not saying this lightly, was trying to calm his nerves.
Yeah.
Because, you see, he's studio-based, whereas I'm actually now much more used to playing live than Brian is. We've been invited to do it again, and he's fighting against that, whereas frankly I love it, you know.
Yeah,
I really do. I get terribly nervous beforehand, but once involved I love the communication you can get with a live audience that is not allowed in recorded music.
There really is nothing quite like it.
No,
right?
Yeah. exactly.
As Robert Fripp once said, you know, the album is a love letter, the live performance is a hot date.
Oh, nice. Yeah. In his delightful West Country accent.
Yes, in that accent it is. So one of the very first times that Brian was on this show, back in the 80s, he said that you were the real musician in the family.
Well, that's kind of him to say, yeah.
Did you play the horn?
Yeah, that's right. Well, what happened was that I went to a school that basically wasn't any good. It was a state school that was rubbish. And I wasn't interested in any of the lessons. But I found a trumpet, a cornet, and I picked up this instrument and I blew it and I got a note out. And I swear to you, John, a light went on. I know it's a cliche, but it absolutely, I thought, right, this is my life. So I started playing music at that point when I was 12. All through school, and nobody noticed I was doing this. So when it came to the end, they said, right, what are you going to do? And I thought, oh, I guess I'll become an electrician. When a geography teacher that played the tuba said, have you thought about going to music college? No one had ever mentioned that would be a possibility. So after that, that's what I did. I went to music college playing the euphonium, which I think in the States is called a baritone, it's a small tuba.
Like a tuba.
There you go.
Yeah.
But at the time, I'll keep this brief, but at the time, that allowed me to play...
No, that ship has sailed, Roger.
There was a ship, but it sailed. Yeah. So it allowed me to play in bands like German Umpa bands, punk rock. I ended up playing in folk groups, dance groups, orchestras, choral. I got a whole scope of music.
And when did you pick up the... I was going to say, when did you pick up the piano?
Right. No, I leave that to others.
Yeah, but I mean, that seems to be your... I know you still play many instruments,
sure,
but that's your main
axe.
No,
definitely. The thing was, when you went to music college, if piano wasn't your first instrument, it was obligatory that it was your second. And I was blessed by having this teacher called Robert Bell, who had a touch that I wanted to emulate. Whatever he played sounded beautiful.
Mm.
So he allowed me not to bother to learn scales, because I said, look, I'm not interested in any of that, but I want to play like you sound. So that's what I did. So I now specialize in the tone of the piano rather than the virtuosity, because there are thousands of people that can do that, and it's not my inclination. Mine is the delicacy that allowed, the tonal quality.
Right, which works so well when you have, over the years, occasionally come together with Brian and done stuff.
Perfectly.
So in 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic, Mixing Colors comes out. Mm-hmm. And whether you intended it this way or not, that album had meaning. It had a purpose.
Yeah, it was extraordinary.
To it.
Yeah, it was the strangest thing because we've had lots of feedback from people saying how vital it was to them at that time. Yet there was something beautifully transient and calming, yet slightly unsettled about that album that seemed to register with a lot of people. And as you said, it's quite unintentional. I mean, Brian had been collecting these pieces that I'd been sending him for about 15 years, these little morning pieces, you know, before the editor was up. I'd send them like postcards to friends of mine, Brian being one of them, like, this is what I'm up to, or this is what came out this morning. So he'd had a collection of things. So it's well beyond the COVID period, you know, the COVID period. But as you say, for somehow it hit people's hearts, and I used to be a music therapist, and I genuinely hope that it did have some sort of therapeutic value for people.
Well, and I'm also wondering, having had that experience, how that might have impacted your intention for the following solo records, for the Turning Year and for the current one. What, if any, is the purpose of those records?
I think in poetic and visual forms, more than musical. So to answer that question, I'll think of the first record as a collection of poems, like each related, like an anthology of poems. With every record I make, I want to have an overall mood where people want it to continue, rather than sticking in a track thinking, oh, it's time to entertain people or keep them awake. I'd far prefer to think that they're using that to enable themselves to inhabit a space for an hour where they can think, that's where I am for this amount of time. I was listening to a fantastic piece by Morton Feldman the other day. And
which one?
Oh, God, I knew you were going to ask for that. Rothko Chapel.
Rothko Chapel. Oh, my God. What an amazing experience.
Isn't that
experience.
Something? Yeah. Isn't that something? Where that fella, I thought, brave man, he puts you in that place for... What is it, 20 minutes, is it?
It's a little longer than that.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly. I know it's a good while.
Yeah, but what happens is you just lose a sense of time at a good performance.
Precisely. And that's the kind of thing that I do. Although I'm more of a miniaturist than he was, so in that I'll split them into tracks. But each track, I'm very, very particular about running order. I still view making a record like an old record, mm-hmm. where there were tracks and a needle. Where if you put it on, it was an arse to get up and have to move it. You know, so you get the running order right. So I spend a lot of time ordering. Even though it's a CD or now, you know, Spotify or whatever, I'll make a point of having a running order that can be put on that sounds entirely natural where the next piece comes.
Right. Now, you don't have to worry about that with this next piece because it's not on Spotify. It's not on a record yet. This is one that the editor hasn't gotten to yet. So what is Shadow Clock?
Shadow Clock started, it's another one of these, you're absolutely right, it's when I was upstairs I bought a beautiful new old piano 2 years ago. It's a 1904 Bechstein upright, Model 9. It's like the best they made. It's just wonderful. And it's got this intimate touch, and I was doodling around, and out comes this very, very simple ostinato pattern in the left hand, and the simplest of melodies. But play it well, and you've got a full vision. Mm. And this is what I'm very interested about, is that when I die on my headstone, I'm going to have Decomposer. Roger Eno, Decomposer. Partly because what I do now is take out as much as I put in, which you can do if you're using like Logic or Pro Tools or whatever. You know, you can splatter it out and then take great gouges out.
Well, that's sculpting.
Yeah, precisely that. Precisely. Yeah. So here you go. Here's a little sculpture for you.
All right. The piece is called Shadow Clock, currently unreleased work from Roger Eno. This one is solo. We'll hear Cecily again on vocals in a few minutes. But Roger Eno at our piano. And he will be playing at the piano at National Sawdust in Brooklyn with our friends from ACME, the American Contemporary Music Ensemble, on Friday and Saturday night, the 29th and 30th. The 29th is sold out. You might still be able to score tickets for Saturday night, the 30th. Here's Roger Eno live in our studio. That is Roger Eno, live at Our Piano, and the piece called Shadow Clock, a currently unreleased work that you've had a chance to hear live, and possibly again in Brooklyn at National Sawdust.
Playing that one, when I work with string players now, I give them often what amounts to an open score. So I'll say, play harmonics around this note. So I'll let people... I like doing this very much, where the piece kind of composes itself. So there'll be that as the bassist, or roughly something like that. But then you'll have all these lovely whistles and kind of squeaks and interrupted things going on.
Things that, similar to what Brian would do electronically with your piano pieces on Mixing Colors. And, you know, a song like Above and Below.
Right.
The subtitle Crepuscular, because it is a very twilight
isn't
piece.
Isn't it?
Thank you. it sort of accumulates sound as it goes. You're playing the piano and there's some very kind of evocative acoustic sounds, and then by the end there are these distant, hard to place sounds.
I can tell you a curious story about that, because it was written as a commission, and that was an electronic piece that I did in my studio, so it was an electronic basis. But then I did a version of it for string quartet. So I thought, well, I wonder what happens if you put them together, because there was no common time. The notes were the same, but the timings were different. And I popped them on top, so you've got slight events that are regular, which gives it this kind of pleasantly off-center feel. So it was kind of two versions of the same piece that worked when put together.
And that's the version that we get on
on
the record, which is called The Skies, They Shift Like Clouds, which is a very landscapey title, not for the first time in your career. And so let's talk about landscape. East Anglia, you know, actually, Brian has done, you know, some of On Land
specifically
about East Anglia. But he left, you know, he still lived there.
No, he's got another, because I kept writing him letters about how great it was, and he was living in London. I mean, he's still got a place in London. But I said, God, you really ought to come out. The walks are, you know, rapturous letters. So he decided to buy a house. So now we're neighbours again, which is great. You know, we go out cycling together and walking on the coast and what have you. So, what keeps me there is that it's the kind of end of the world. The next stop is Holland, really. So there's no motorways that go into the area. And for me, it's ideal for working. There are marshes. Wildlife's fantastic. The coast is very active. It's eroding all the time. So there's this feeling that of transience, of time passing, which is something that's always intrigued me, but is increasingly becoming more important as I get older, which happens to everyone, I'm sure, you know. You realise that more's behind you than in front. So it has it's had various effects on me. Like, I've been noticing the world as being much more beautiful than hitherto, you know. It's like, God, this really is worth kind of mentally photographing this moment.
Is that how you view your pieces, as little photographs?
Exactly that.
So a subtitle like Crepuscular suggests a time of day.
There you go.
You have that special light then.
Yeah. Harold Budd was a man that advised me on that. I got on really well with Harold. We used to tour together. And apart from being one of the finest musicians that I've come across, because his music was extraordinary.
Yeah.
He was also one of the funniest people I'd ever met. He had me honestly on the floor in tears of laughter. We once did a tour of Spain, Harold and I, with Michael Brook, I think, and Raji may have been there. And Harold and I drank the train dry. And it was in the middle of the Spanish desert, you know, where all the spaghetti movies at Westerns.
The spaghetti Westerns?
Filmed. Yeah, yeah. And bless the Spanish train company, because they stopped the train to get more beer on for us. But Harold told me the importance of a good title. So if you look at his works, they've all got very, like the Plateau of Mirror, it's a very evocative title. You don't quite know what it means, but you know it means something.
Yeah.
So when you title a piece of work, it's a way of allowing or inviting someone else into what you've done. So I spend a lot of time thinking about titles, and a lot of time, as I mentioned, thinking about the running order. And both of those things are to enable the listener a more visual, I think, way of a visual understanding of what I'm doing.
Well, and Harold, you know, in his later years when he was doing poetry as well as music, you know, he did a song and poem with the title Dead Horse Alive with Flies.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yes.
It's a title you do not forget.
No, no.
Because it conjures up a very strong mental
image.
Oh,
doesn't it just? Doesn't it just?
Maybe not one I want to hang on to very long,
sure.
But you know,
yeah.
It is an inescapable visual image.
Yes.
And the skies drifting, you know, the clouds scudding across the landscape. I mean, you know, you summon that when...
Thank you. I hate to say this, but I'm going to have to put you right on one thing. It's the skies, they shift like chords.
Oh, okay. Yes.
But that's all right. That can be rectified because the clouds would be the obvious way to go.
Yeah.
But
that is the poetry of it.
Yeah.
I can't believe I got that wrong.
You've got some serious editing to do later. The clouds.
It's not worth editing. You know.
Because we got a laugh out of it.
So it seems like you are a fan of lots of different types of of classical music.
Sure.
You mentioned Morton Feldman earlier. The opening piece on the album, The Skies They Shift Like Chords, is called Chordal Drift.
Right.
It reminds me of the famous Thomas Tallis motet,
Spem
in Allium.
Yeah, what a piece. The Tudor music of that period, particularly the English Tudor music, of a later period, Thomas Tallis and William Byrd, which is about the date of that ring I'm wearing, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, that's between 1450 and 1530.
A family ring?
No, I found it. Here you go. John's holding this now, so if I never get it back, remember John had it last.
Did you fish this out of the Thames at low tide or something?
I found it in a junk shop, believe it or not, and it was very reasonable. Yeah, so I like the idea that time is almost elastic.
I think the thing, though, that reminded me of Tallis in Chordal Drift is just the kind of thickness.
The density.
Density of the texture.
Yes.
You know?
Again, using a painting analogy, if you look at skillful painters, they'll go from using hardly anything to like impasto, which is as thick as you can get, you know, where it's almost, it's 3D.
Yeah, right.
Depending on what effect they wish to get. So I love the idea that you can write music that's almost transparent. You know, it's like if you touched it, it would disappear into this sort of thing that you're talking about, which is like a wall of sound.
Yes.
Yeah. That you can't walk any further. You hit it and you can't get further on.
All right. Should we wake up Cecily and hear another song?
I think that'd be a good idea. I've got to say, before I play that, you've got one of the best pianos I've played. That Steinway B is fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Honestly.
I'm glad you like it. I'm going to send you back over there so we can hear another song.
We're exactly the same age, that piano and I, you know?
Well, you and I and the piano then.
Is that right?
Yes.
You're younger than I do. What do?
I run around a lot.
Do you?
So, Roger Eno back at our piano, and once again, Cecily Eno at the microphone, and they're going to do a song called Tapestry.
Ooh.
That is called Tapestry. Roger Eno at our piano, thanking his daughter, Cecily Eno, who is the vocalist, as he makes his way back to the microphone. And Roger, you were talking about, you know, prettiness versus harshness, and that song is full of chromaticism.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just beautiful.
Oh, I mean, bless you. Thank you. Thanks.
I mean, you could easily make a song like that with all those chromatic notes and singing minor seconds into something jagged and, prickly. But instead, it comes off as sounding kind of modal and, exotic.
It's the question of where you feel. We were talking about, I think before we were on air, we were talking about how Dr. John plays.
Yes, yeah.
But his style was rooted in where he was from, what he heard as a child and what he lived. So myself as a composer, I like the idea that I'm being true to what I know, as well as trying to further that, rather than thinking, right, I'll dump all that and just try something else because, for whatever reason, because I think it's time to do something else. I think it's a good idea to be true to yourself, to what you regard as your own experiences, because what we've been talking about is, it's how I see the world, basically, right, isn't it? And I don't want to reject that just because it's kind of becoming popular. That way of working has become much more popular than
the whole. They're calling it neoclassical now.
Right. Well, that's the bracket that I find. That was interesting. I got on Virgin Atlantic. It was the maiden voyage of the flight that Cecily and I were on, which I didn't want to think as we were going over the Atlantic, the Titanic kept coming. It kept coming into my mind. But in the playlist, there was my two Deutsche Grammophon records on it, which I found very... Sis found it by accident, actually. I found that very gratifying for some reason.
You know what I find gratifying? I spent many years coaching a travel soccer team that my daughter played on.
Oh, right.
And on Saturday mornings now, she comes and plays in my game with me.
Oh,
and
fabulous.
Playing with my daughter is like the highlight of my week. Yeah. And here you are with Sess.
Oh.
I mean, what is... I guess I should ask Sess this question, which is... What is it like to be touring with your dad?
Well, I don't really know what comparison I sort of have for it. I think you kind of have to have had an alternate experience in order to then contextualize this one, but I don't really have that. So all I can say is it's great. I don't know. I think, I'd need to be in... have had some other movable pieces to then give you, like a comparative.
Have you sung with your uncle?
Yeah. Well, as part of the Athens show.
The Acropolis
show.
Yeah, we
sung together.
But you've recorded with Brian in his studio, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. I've done some sneaky backing vocals before for him.
Right, okay.
tell this, because I think John would be interested.
Yeah,
don't
yeah.
say if you feel uncomfortable. When I asked you last night why you sing with me or something, tell them what you told me.
Oh yeah, so we had a twin room last night, and just as we were both falling asleep, Roger was asking me something about sort of why I chose to sing with him, or saying something about working together and how the experience might be different for both of us. And I said, if I'm completely honest, it's because I know you're going to die at some point. Like, I know that probably sounds morbid, or it's maybe like plunging into the depths too much, but that's honestly the thing, is kind of recognizing that the time is finite in some way, and thinking, because a lot of people would choose not to work with their families, right? I know multiple people that kind of ask, like, oh, how is that? Is it difficult to navigate, etc.? And I think regardless, I'm not going to have it forever. So even if it was difficult, it would be that kind of thing of like, am I going to look back and wish that I'd chosen that difficulty for the sacredness of it?
And spending hours with like my daughter and some of her teammates in the back of the car while I'm traveling hours on the road to get them to their next tournament or whatever, I don't regret any
there
of
you
that.
Go.
because I know I'm not going to have that.
All.
So, Roger.
Yeah. For me, it just reduces me to tears of joy playing with her.
Well, Friday and Saturday night in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Roger Eno with ACME, the American Contemporary Music Ensemble. Friday night, the 29th, sold out. You might be able to get tickets for Saturday, the 30th. It's really been great to have you
here with us. Honestly, a real pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, Sess. The latest album by Roger Eno is called The Skies They Shift Like Chords. And Irene Trudell is our technical director. Karen Havlick's down the hall in the video control room. The videos of these performances coming to the New Sounds YouTube channel. I'm John Schaefer. You can keep up with everything we're doing on New Sounds by subscribing to our free weekly newsletter. Text New Sounds to 70101. Or sign up on the website at newsounds.org.